There we go.
Again, Bruce, this is a conference call with Dr. Carlo DiClemente.
Okay. So basically, we're going to focus on process. The work that I'm showing here has lots of support from a variety of groups. I am a consultant and receive royalties from Prevention Research Institute on a program called Solutions there, and I'm on the ward of Westbridge Treatment Programs. And I just want to thank, at the beginning, all of my graduate and undergraduate students in my laboratories over the years who have helped build this particular project. So the three challenges I want to look at today is, the first is, I think, in addictions, we need to shift from an end state and diagnostic perspective to a dynamic process of change orientation. That's probably no surprise to anybody who's read any of my work. The second is really understanding a use disorder, both the initiation and recovery, as a journey and not an event. The third is really kind of integrating treatment into a multidimensional view of addiction. So we'll look at all three of those, the three challenges. So the first challenge is really, I think we need to kind of understand and define use disorders and addiction that's beyond DSM-5. I don't think we get much arguments from the psychologists in the group. That's multidimensional, but that's also relevant for recovery. So I'm hoping to show how that works. For me, addictions are these: habitual patterns of intentional, appetitive behaviors. And, you know, I know there's all this issue about choice. I'm not saying everybody chooses to be addicted, but there is intentional pieces of that. They become excessive, problematic, produce serious consequences. They actually become stable over time, these patterns. I mean, many of the smokers I've worked with have been smoking for 20 years. The alcohol folks have been 10 to 20 years of drinking the way they're drinking. So these patterns become pretty stable. And the stability is really because of the interrelated physiological, psychological, and social components. The final thing is that addictive individuals have difficulty modifying and stopping these patterns of behavior. It doesn't matter which of these patterns we're talking about. But once you reach that point where we call you addicted, that's what happens. So if you think about addiction and change, move to the next slide, both acquisition and recovery from addiction are this journey. Each journey is influenced by these, and then, I think that's almost a comma. So go to the next slide, the course of addiction. From a behavioral perspective, luckily not everybody that experiments becomes dependent or a serious use disorder. Hold on a second here. So what you see is that only a small group of people actually move through this process all the way through to dependence. And that's lucky, because if you grew up in the 60s, there's a lot of people who used marijuana who never became dependent on marijuana. And lucky, because in college, there's a lot of people who misuse the college stuff but don't get in there. So we need to think about that. So if you go to the next slide, what you'll see is we need to put a process perspective over top of this behavioral perspective so that we can really understand the journey. And as you see, what I see is that initiation of addiction goes through a similar process of change as recovery. So you go through the pre-contemplation, contemplation, preparation, action, and you reach maintenance in initiation. And once you're in maintenance and initiation, you're probably in pre-contemplation for recovery. And then you would have to go through those recovery stages. The research that I've been doing and the thinking that I've been doing is the process is similar, even though initiation, modification, and cessation are different patterns of behavior change. The process seems to be a similar one if you're thinking about an intentional change process, which is what we're talking about. If you go to the next slide, then we think about the stages. So what are these stages? Well, the stages are really just labels. They're not that helpful as labels. They're only helpful in terms of what the tasks that they tell us are needed to move forward in this process. So if you're in pre-contemplation, yes, it's nice to know you're not interested in quitting or doing something about your addiction, but what do I have to do to move you forward is get you interested and concerned and willing to kind of consider change. If you're in contemplation, the task is really a risk-reward analysis and decision-making. If you're in preparation, it's really a commitment, building commitment, and creating a plan that's effective and acceptable. It's got to be both of those, or it doesn't work. It's got to be acceptable to the person. So these tasks are actually the tasks of the changer, and the helper has to kind of help these tasks along. Action is implementing the plan and revising the plan, because all the plans have flaws. And if you don't revise, what most people do is, instead of revising the plan, they give up on the change. And that's why I think we need that kind of revision process, because that helps us to kind of avoid the trap that relapses, you're done now. So start over again. And then finally, maintenance is really consolidating change into a lifestyle and making it a very solid new behavior pattern. That's what we're really talking about. So the understanding is that as individuals move through the stages of initiation, they move from thinking about it to experimenting to develop a pattern of behavior that could be social drinking, binge drinking, daily drinking, non-drinking, that becomes habitual and consistent over time. So many of these patterns are normative and socially acceptable. So I'm sure, we're not outing anybody on the call, but that all of us many of us drink socially. And it's normative to do that, 60% of the population drink. But we do it in a way that doesn't create problems or get judged as excessive, hopefully. Addiction, however, is best represented as a well-maintained, problematic pattern of engagement, best equated with a severe, maybe a late moderate or severe use disorder or dependence. And once the individual has created such a maintained pattern and becomes stable and part of who they are, then the process of recovery needs to help move them through those stages into recovery. So stages really are pattern neutral. So many of us have moved through stages of initiation to a regular pattern of consuming alcohol. Some have actually, I've smoked in the past, so I'm smoking. Some have regularly gamble, whether it's internet or whatever. So it's critical to be able to distinguish among engagement patterns, and that's why it's really important to know what use versus misuse versus abuse versus dependence. And that's going to get more important as more states kind of legalize marijuana, and we struggle with a lot of pain medications and other kinds of things, we need to kind of understand that. And we need to kind of know what mild, moderate, and severe is. And I'll tell you, I don't think 6 of 11 does it for me. So the other thing that's really important is to understand that the trajectories can change over time. So social use can, you're a social user, you get a divorce, and you move into misuse and sometimes dependence. And develop and sometimes these patterns depend on developmental and contextual factors. Thank God that binge drinking in college is usually, for many of the people, a limited a heavy binge drinking pattern. Once they leave college, some of that changes. So we need to know that people move in and out of these different kind of patterns. So the real distinction is motivation focuses on how individuals move into and out of these different patterns, and addiction really focuses on the end state. So that's the distinction that I make. So if you think about initiation, and I'll do that and then kind of just open it up for questions after a couple of minutes. So if this stage process works for initiation. So again, what gets people out of pre-contemplation into contemplation is sometimes environmental pressures. You need to do this. We're seeing a spike in e-cigarette use. Some of that is, it's cool. Somebody told me it's cool and I got to do this. Some personal concerns, I'm not cool enough. But whatever it is, that helps push the process forward. There's also expectancies and beliefs that move folks, because that's what they think about this particular behavior. In contemplation, there's a decisional balance process. And I think of experimentation as part of contemplation. And I know that's going to confuse people, because a lot of times our prevention programs are trying to prevent experimentation. And I'm not convinced that we can prevent experimentation. I think we can prevent moving forward in that process. But experimentation oftentimes is just part of what people do when they see new behaviors or things are cool. And especially during adolescence, it's a time of experimentation. But experimentation can move you one way or the other. So some people smoke their first cigarette and go, I'm never doing that again. That's terrible. And they move back into pre-contemplation. Other people try and move forward. Say, well, that was not so good, but intriguing. Let me see if where I need to go from here. So again, then the cognitive experiential processes bring in and some self-reevaluation. How do I think about myself with regard to this behavior? What about my group? What about environmental reevaluation? And then you move forward into preparation, and then you move into action and maintenance. And in preparation, often you have casual use, then you got moved to regular use, and then, you know, regular use over a period of time we're calling dependence. And that's from some of the research stuff that we're doing. So let me show you a couple of pieces of data that come from our research here in Maryland on the Maryland Youth Tobacco Survey. So we were looking at stages of initiation and trying to kind of find out youth who are not currently smoking and have a firm commitment not to start again in the next year. We're calling that pre-contemplation. Then people who aren't currently smoking but do not express a firm commitment, we're kind of calling contemplation. Youth who have minimally tried cigarettes, so not more than 100 cigarettes in their lifetime, which is the definition of a smoker, a lifetime smoker, but who may be currently smoking less than 6 days in the past 30, and that's called preparation. And then youth who have smoked for six or more days during the past 30 days and for less than 6 months are action. Youth who have done that for more than 6 months are called maintenance. So what we've done is we've tried to kind of look through the epidemiological data and understand what happened. So if you look at the Maryland Youth Tobacco Survey, we looked at the data from 2000 to 2010. What you can see is that over that time, there's been a dramatic decrease in adults and underaged middle school youth, high school youth, that there's been a decrease in smoking. So we know that. The only thing that was not, during this time period, the only thing that wasn't, it didn't decrease was cigar smoking. So cigar smoking increased during that time period. But what we also tried to do then is to try and look from the next one is this is the stages of change over time by school status. So if you look at middle school, what you'll see is that in these surveys that have been done, this is 80,000 kids from all the high schools and middle schools across the state of Maryland. You'll see that, you know, as you move through this time period where you get decreases in the behavior, you also get increases in pre-contemplation. So the percentage of kids in pre-contemplation in 2010 is 84%. And what you'll notice is the kids in action, the percentage in action and maintenance goes down dramatically. So you'll see behavior change, but you also see cognitive change. You also see in middle school some changes in contemplation, where that's going down, and changes in preparation. So what's really happening in middle school is there's a lot more shift to early stage kind of status and away from latent stage status. In the high schools, it's not totally the same, but it's similar. That pre-contemplation changes over time. But again, in high school, you have fewer, a smaller percentage of people who are in there. And what you see is not as much dramatic change in contemplation, but you do see, again, a dramatic change from 18% of the population in action and maintenance in 2000 to 7 or 8% in action and maintenance in 2010. So does that make a difference? Does stage make a difference? Well, we look at, so this is the same period, and you'll see that the lines in this next slide are really representing all the stages. And what you'll see is this question was in the survey. If your best friend offered you a cigarette, would you accept a cigarette your best friend offered? And the answer is yes or no. The percentage of kids who said yes follows the stages, obviously. That very few kids in pre-contemplation in middle school or high school. But if you get into maintenance, almost 100% will say yes. And it goes up gradually from contemplation. You still have 20% who will say yes. So then we asked, what about the number of your four closest friends who smoke? Well, if you look at this data, what you'll see is there's a dramatic difference. There's hardly a quarter of a friend who smokes for those in pre-contemplation in middle school, and maybe a half of a friend in high school. But if you're in action maintenance, almost three out of four of your friends are smoking. And we think about, they're all peer pressure, they're getting, this is peer affiliation, not just peer pressure. So as they get into more of the smoking habit, they hang out more with the people who do those things. And that's interesting, because this is another one that's interesting, is believe that smoking makes people look cool by the stages. What you see is that the kids in preparation who are not smoking regularly have almost as high a score on this, especially in middle school, than the kids in high school. The kids in high school who are regular smokers think it isn't as cool as some of the percentage of those thinking it's cool is less than the percentage of those thinking it's cool who are in preparation. So stage status does make a difference. The other thing is that you can look at the patterns of use over time. And you'll see here in the next slide that a lot of people use not just one thing. They use multiple things. Alcohol, cigarettes, marijuana. So we were able to track that in these surveys in 2010. And what you can tell is this is the stages of change for smoking, and then the percentage of kids who binge drank reported five or more drinks on one occasion in the past month. And what you'll see is that the kids who are regular smokers, 60 to 80% of them in action and maintenance have report binge drinking. Even some of the kids in preparation look high, but the kids in pre-contemplation and contemplation are much lower. It's 20% of those kids. So if I have your smoking status, in terms of stages, I can somewhat predict where you're going to be in terms of binge drinking. So we need to think globally about this stuff, not about preventing each drug. And that gets more clear here. So here are the stages of change in middle school and high school in 2010 for cigarettes, drinking alcohol, and marijuana by middle school and high school. And you'll see that the big outlier is alcohol in high school, 32% in pre-contemplation, 17% in action, 15% in maintenance of drinking alcohol regularly. Okay. And marijuana is very little lots of pre-contemplation for marijuana and cigarettes in middle school, less so in high school. So this gives you a perspective on where kids are and what's happening in the process of change for initiation of addictions. And this is just another, if you cross-tab stages of alcohol initiation with stages of smoking initiation, you'll see that there's an association. The kids earlier in stages of smoking initiation are also in early stages for alcohol initiation. The kids who are maintenance for smoking are also in action and maintenance for alcohol initiation. And that's the same for marijuana. So I'm not going to go through that. If you look at the next slide, it's the marijuana initiation by the smoking initiation. It's a very similar pattern. And these are just the high school kids in Maryland. So we're not, but obviously those are patterns of people who have done both. So it's clear that the end state of an initiation of a moderate to severe use disorder represents kind of a stable, sustained pattern of behavior that's difficult to modify and may be involved in lots of different other substances. So we now will move on to the critical mechanisms or dimensions that keep people doing these behaviors and keeping them in the pre-contemplation stage for recovery. But I'll stop for a second and see if there's a quick question. Everybody's still on, right, Mark?
I'm on.
Yeah,
okay.
Hi. much of what seems to be reflected in the slides is that early intervention is and education is still perhaps going to have the best outcomes.
So, yes, I think we need to be thinking about where kids are as to target the prevention activity. So we sometimes, you know, if you're down in preparation and action, this isn't primary prevention. This is secondary prevention. So we need mixes of prevention to address the kids in these different stages. Otherwise, we give messages, oh, cocaine, the first time you use it, you'll die. Well, anybody in preparation who's already tried it and knows people, and or action or maintenance knows you're full of bull. We know differently. So if you don't target where people are, the process is different. So you need to do different kinds of things to interrupt moving forward in the stages of initiation. But good question. All right. Hearing none other, I will move forward. Okay. So moving down here, if we think about then, once you get to that end state, and again, I'm talking about addiction here, but initiation, like I said, maintenance could be for maintenance for social drinking. And so we have maintained patterns of social drinking that, you know, maybe it, every once in a while we screw up, but basically it's a pattern of social drinking that is under self-regulation. And that's not what I'm talking here. So that would be a different strategy. So you can move forward in this and you can go to dependence, you can go up to social drinking, you can go to non-drinking, you can do all kinds of things once you've moved through these stages of initiation. But once you're in that severe use disorder or moderate to severe use disorder, often you're in pre-contemplation for recovery. And that's what you now need to move through is do that. Now, why do people stay there? Well, I think we need a new perspective on addiction severity. We need one that will help us with diagnosis, but will help us understand how severity influences motivation and its movement through the process of recovery. And it should offer us specifics for guiding treatment. So 6 out of 11 from the DSM does nothing for us in terms of guiding treatment planning and treatment matching. If you go to the next slide, here's what I think. So this is what I've done it in the book, Addiction and Change, but this is some of the work that I've done with Ray Doherty. So we've thought about, okay, let's look at addiction severity in a different perspective. So if I'm going to do that, what do I need? Well, I need quantity frequency. I need dimensions, not categories. I need highlighting critical mechanisms that how the addictive behavior operates in the life of this individual. And I need to include biological, psychological, behavioral factors and context. So that's my assumption, that if I really wanted to understand this, I mean, Tom McClellan's work on addiction severity has much to do with context and other kinds of problems. Some of the other work that's been done looks at some of these dimensions, but it doesn't dimensionalize in a way that I think is helpful. So here's my take on it, and you can agree or not. So quantity frequency. Quantity frequency is really important. It's important for motivational goals because, again, I don't know what cutting down means. It depends on where you're starting. And as an indicator of change. So are you creating a different pattern of use? We've done that with some of our policy. So we actually have created a lot of weekend smokers with our policies, because that, you know, many of the people, and they don't even consider themselves smokers, will go, oh, I only smoke on the weekends, so I'm not really a smoker. But that's a different pattern. When I got in this work originally, you couldn't find a weekend smoker. I mean, everybody smoked all the time. There's, you know, it was like a pack and a half a day for most of the time for most smokers. So we need to kind of understand that changes in pattern. And then, amazingly, if you look at the DSM and many of these measures of severity, they don't include quantity frequency. And I know it's hard to do quantity frequency in some of these behaviors, but golly, Shouldn't we have quantum frequency in our understanding of addiction? So what we've done is kind of think about, well, maybe we could just think about use patterns. Because, again, quantity isn't, you know, I need to know if you did 12 drinks or 10 drinks. I need to know the pattern. So no risk, low risk, infrequent high risk, frequent high risk, and extensive high risk are my shots at trying to think of a use pattern so that you could really understand where someone is at, in terms of their use. Then I move to mechanisms. So if you really think about mechanisms, and these are, you know, I know many of these are represented in the 11 diagnostic signs and symptoms in the DSM, but there's not, there are no organizations. So if I think of mechanisms of addiction severity, there's three that are key from my perspective. One is neurobiological adaptation. The brain changes in response to any psychotropic substance or the substances, all the addictive substances. And this is, I think, where people kind of say, oh, this is a brain disease. But neurobiological adaptation is only one aspect of the mechanism. The second is a reduced or impaired self-regulation. These medications impact the self-regulatory process because they impact both the executive cognitive functioning and affect regulation. So it impacts that process that's going on. So we need to know where that is. For this particular individual. And in this case, you call it a behavioral control disease. The last is really salience. Salience or you know, it's really the narrowing of the behavioral repertoire in behavioral terms. Salience is really how has this behavior become in terms of a valued reinforcer? Where is it in the life of this individual? Has it become more ubiquitous, more potent? Where is it? So if I know about salience, I know something about what's left of this person's life that's not impacted or not co-opted by this addictive behavior. And what you see in lots of people who are really in severe use disorders is it's their life. So getting the next fix starts immediately after you get high. And your life is really taken over by that. And knowing that in reduced in regulation, neurobiologic adaptation, and salience are how operative they are is an important thing that we should know. So that's the second dimension. The third dimension is context. And this is where I think a lot of our measures of severity look at contextual or consequences. So we have a lot of consequence measures. The Rutgers, the RAPI, all of those are consequence measures. How much has this impacted various areas of this person's life? So this is different from salience. I think this is really the consequences, not simply salience. But how much has it impacted life biologically? You know, does this person have hepatitis C? What about the neuropsychological consequences? What about the psychological thing? How much has this kind of become a coping mechanism for that person, a way to manage all the negative feelings? And you'll see most addictions, it's, I get frustrated, I have to use. It's really an emotion coping mechanism. And then social, how integrated into the social context and the network, how much does it meet social and interpersonal needs is really important. So now we have context as well. So we have quantity frequency, you have mechanisms, you have context, and this is a way that we could try and look at how do we define the end state of addiction. So you could look at the mechanisms, and we could know now how if we could measure it well, I understand there's a measurement issue here, look at where is somebody in neurobiological reduced self-regulation and salience from mild to severe. We also can know how much of that domain that individual has is affected. So these different colors are to kind of say, okay, well, it may affect differentially different aspects of the context of that person or individual. So that would just tell you that, that a person with this kind of a profile in the next slot would be different. I mean, mild to moderate on the indicators, infrequent high use, but there may be some really serious social consequences. There may be some legal consequences for this person. And so you can take a look and you can see, and that person would clearly be different from this person, the next slide, who has extensive high risk, is severe on most of those indicators, and then also has severity across many of those domains in terms of there's a lot of flow into those consequences into all three of these areas from this particular individual. And we should treat this person differently than the person before. So that's the idea of trying to understand addiction and addiction severity and why that's important in and gives us dimensions to kind of look at how to titrate and match our treatments to the individual. I mean, I got to say that in my work in Houston, I used to do EAP work, I had a guy come in and says, I haven't used cocaine, but I did use it in the past. My fiance is really upset. I got to assure her that this is not a problem. I'm going, let's think about that. Come on back in. We'll have a conversation. So he was so anxious about it. He went to one of these hospitals that said, we'll give you a free evaluation. And then this is Friday. He calls me on Saturday and goes, they won't let me out. They tell me I have an addiction to cocaine and that I have to be in treatment and I have a 72-hour hold. I go, what the hell? The guy hasn't used for 6 months. But that's the perspective that a lot of, that was a bad, obviously a bad hospital. And I had to call the supervisor and the residents are on call, but I had to call the supervisor and give him hell and said I was going to call the police if he didn't do something to let this person out. We have to know dimensions and what are we talking about when we say an addiction? And the severity, I think, is an important piece of that. So what are the implications? Well, I think if you have this kind of perspective, that you connect neuroscience and biological perspectives with social and behavioral science perspectives better. So we're not split to MAT or psychosocial treatment. No, you need to deal with all of those mechanisms. And psychosocial treatment deals with some of those mechanisms, and medication deals with some of those mechanisms. It offers a better way to measure use disorders, a more dimensional approach. It can help us distinguish and define between use and misuse and abuse. And then it offers a way to bring together literatures, some of Koob's work on stress reactivity, some of the work on brain mechanisms. Rajita Singh is doing some interesting work looking at brain mechanisms for relapse. That really parallels some of the work that I've done looking at temptation and confidence as a predictor. It's really interesting to bring those things together. Self-regulation, loss of control, and then internal and environmental perspectives. So that's what I think about that. So how do these dimensions interact with motivation? If recovery, as I said, is this series of tasks, and motivation is behavioral and goal-specific, then understanding the neurobiological adaptation, the impaired self-regulation, and self-control mechanisms is critical to understanding how we need to help this person to manage the addictive behavior and reduce use. Neuroadaptation, salience, and impaired self-regulation interact with ambivalence, decision-making, commitment, support, planning, and action, as well as relapse and recycling. And the contextual issues that are going on, sometimes if you have few contextual issues, it can provide resources for you. So some of our best clients who have not burned out all of their resources but do want to change their addictive behavior are able to do so a little easier because of the resources in the content. Whereas some of the people where the context is chaotic, it creates real hard problems for recovery. And that's true for a variety of of individuals. So again, I'm going to stop there and ask if there are any quick questions. Okay, that's totally clear. That's good. All right, I'll keep moving so that we can have some time for questions at the end if you want. Okay, so when I think about mechanisms of change, which I know Division 50 has been working on, Katie Witkowitz and a lot of the people have been doing that, I use a client perspective. A lot of times when people talk about mechanisms of change, they're talking about what the therapist does. That's not where I think the mechanisms of change are. I mean, it's helpful, but that's not where they are. Okay, so the question is, what's the provider's job and what's the client's job? And so from my perspective, the client really, it's about their processes, their activities, their movement through the tasks of the stages of change. For the provider, it's the strategies and the services that you offer. And I like to make a distinction between a change plan and a treatment plan. A lot of people think of a treatment plan as a change plan. It's not. The treatment plan is what you're going to do. The change plan is what the client's going to do. The change plan should also drive the treatment plan, always, instead of vice versa. And the treatment plan should always be in the service of the change plan. So it just changes your perspective to a process perspective because we're focusing on the client and what they're doing and what their process is. So many of you, if you know about the model, know about the processes of change. Usually experiential processes are more relevant or more salient in early stages, and the behavioral processes in later stages. This, I will say to you, depends on the process. A lot of this has come from recovery. So that's really a cessation modification kind of program. But that initiation uses the same processes, but in a little bit different titration. So these are the processes. I'm not going to go through them with you. You can read them later. But they're really, if you think about the processes of change, this is the reason why we call it the trans-theoretical model. The processes of change are really principles of change that come from different systems of therapy. And so you'll see a lot of these systems, cognitive therapy focuses a lot on self-reevaluation and environmental reevaluation. Psychodynamic approaches use a lot of consciousness raising. Gestalt approaches use a lot of emotional arousal. But these processes, if we look at them in terms of what the client is doing, that's the background behind the trans-theoretical model. Behavioral processes are similar. You have the Skinnerian, the Pavlovian, the humanistic self-liberation pieces, and you have the helping relationship support system. Again, all of these processes, though, are behavior-specific, similar to the tasks. So I've worked in hospitals where the person comes in and says, I have a problem with cocaine. And so they do an evaluation, and they go, this person also has an alcohol problem. So for these were the good old days of 28 days. For the 28 days that the person was in the hospital, the staff fought with him about whether or not he had an alcohol problem instead of working on the cocaine problem, because they totally compromised the whole stay. And I think, you know, we need to know that working on the alcohol problem doesn't necessarily mean you're working on the cocaine problem. And you know that because we have a lot of people on MAT who are using other substances, not heroin. And they're going, I'm off opiates. Yes, but you're on other things. Yes. So the initiation process and the cessation process is different depending on the different substances. So this is our pattern that we found in smoking and actually in other projects. But again, the pattern holds for initiation and recovery, but the process might be somewhat different. And again, what you see clearly is in initiation, we're talking about condition, not counter condition.
We'll be available till Monday.
Okay,
somebody's not. We're hearing your conversation.
Just a reminder, please put your phone on mute. Thank you.
I ask you about an item in the slide that follows task completion and movement between stages. I'm not clear on what it means. It's item number 3 with a red asterisk. It says, however, process dimensions of change discriminated between the drinking outcomes in project.
Okay, you're way ahead of me. You're way ahead.
Oh, okay.
I'm back on the stages and processes by stage. So okay. The conscious breathing, self-reevaluation, emotional arousal, I'll get to that in a minute. So again, in initiation, we're talking about creating cues, not controlling cues. So the process is a little bit different, and some of these processes are a little bit different depending on whether you're initiating, modifying, or stopping a behavior. So if you think about getting into and staying in recovery, it requires completion of stage tasks in a manner that's sufficient to support long-term recovery. You're using the processes of change that can promote and deepen these tasks, the completion of these tasks, and building confidence and avoiding overconfidence and being realistic. So that's what it takes to really stay in recovery. And that's what this next slide shows, task completion and movement between the stages. You can move forward in some of these stages with a different modicums of completing those tasks. The individuals who seem to be the most successful have completed these tasks well. Now, if you ask me, what does well mean? I don't know. Retrospectively, we can tell. But going forward, you've had clients who kind of rush through some of these early stages, go, yes, I'm ready to do it, and then try to bare-knuckle their way through action without really a plan. And often they get tired and they relapse. So you have to go back through. So the whole point of recycling is they have to get these things done well enough to support movement through the rest of the process. Okay. So to show this, I want to show you these success profiles that we have from Project Match. And I just want to say, I did this work with Joe Carbonari. Joe just died last week, so I'm going to kind of do this in honor of him and recognizing his contribution to a lot of the work that we've done. This was Project Match. 3 treatments, all 12 weeks of differing. Matt only had 4 sessions. The other 2 had 12 sessions. When we looked at outcomes, there were no important differences between these 3 treatments on stage subscales, working alliance, temptation to drink, absence, self-efficacy, experiential behavioral processes at the end of treatment, and there were no important differences in drinking outcomes. So the 3 treatments actually had very similar outcomes and didn't have much difference in terms of overall of the people in the treatments between that. So what we did was we looked at what do the successes look like compared to the failures on these different process dimensions. So we looked at 3 groups, abstinent, moderate, and heavier drinkers, and we looked at baseline and end of treatment. This is for the outpatients, about 950 people, and looked at their scores on the stages of change, subscales, the temptation to drink, abstinence, self-efficacy, and the processes of change. And what you'll see in the next is the TTM profile outpatient PDA baseline. So this is baseline based on their percent days abstinent over the time. People who were totally abstinent, when they walked in the door, looked different than the heavier drinkers during the 1-year post-treatment time period. Okay? So you can see that the mechanism looks like why I call the success profiles. They were already kind of doing some things. They were lower in pre-contemplation, higher in contemplation and action, higher in kind of struggling to maintain, which is that, and higher in confidence and lower in temptation when they walked in the door. Now let's look at them at the end of treatment, the same groups. So at the end of treatment, this is what they look like. These 5 scales kind of discriminate between the heavier drinkers, the moderate drinkers, and the abstinent drinkers. So what you see is, or the heavier drinkers and the abstinent drinkers, the moderate drinkers are kind of in the middle. The heavier drinkers have low action scores, high struggling to maintain scores, low confidence, high temptation. This is at the end of treatment. And they're not using experiential and behavioral processing. The successes, the ones that are most abstinent are over this time, who are completely abstinent over this time period, have completely the opposite scale on those three, on those five measures. And the interesting thing is the people who are moderate drinkers, so they don't have a binge episode, but they're back to drinking and they're kind of struggling to kind of keep the drinking down, are in the middle on those process measures. So that this is one of the most striking present graphics for me to kind of talk about where people are in the process is really important, because the treatments didn't discriminate, but the process dimensions did. And that's why I think process of change is really important. So this is the model moving through these stages, kind of doing things well enough to keep moving forward, using the processes of change. Relapse kind of happens a lot, but kind of recycling and understanding how those mechanisms and the context impact this process is really critical. So I'm going to finish up by just quickly kind of looking at, so much of our treatment research has been like this. In the foreground has been the therapist, the treatment, the techniques, what we do for recovery, the support, all of those kind of things, and relapse prevention. That's what we focused on in the research. The client, adherence, environment have been there, but they've been in the back. So I'm asking people to think differently about this. So switch the foreground and the background. So treatment should look more like this. Focusing on the process of change. The client is in the foreground. It's the client processes. It's the self-regulation, motivation, mechanisms that are going on that we need to kind of focus on. Then, you know, and environment and biology influence all of that. Then we kind of have the client again, what's going on with the client. The treatment and the therapists are supporting that. And then we have the support systems. And still, the client is in the foreground. So if you focus on the process of change, you'll be focused much more on the client than you will be on the therapist and the therapy process. It's not saying that therapeutic strategies are not important. No, they are. But the strategies are to help when they are most effective is if they help the client meet the tasks and the processes that need to happen to get into and stay in recovery. The other thing that's important is relapse is a reality in addiction treatment. Okay, I mean, I know we want to prevent it. I know we want to, but relapse happens a lot in a lot of things. I also want to say relapse isn't a problem of addictions. Relapse is a problem of behavior change. So we're in the beginning of February. Everybody just look back at your January resolutions and find out where they are. John Norcross did a study and it takes 5 years or 5 to 7 years for people to actually implement a New Year's resolution that they do every year. So we're not a fast group. But what you understand, if you think about the process of change, each intervention is important. And we like to focus on the last one. So we like to say, oh, yeah, we're going to take credit for this change. But the first treatment may have been the most important treatment this person had because it got them on the road to recovery. And then they relapsed, came back, they relapsed, came back, and finally got to the end. And so they got to your program and they were successful. Okay, take credit, but realize you owe a lot to the people in the past. Okay, so that's the book that has a lot more information about this, and here's some references that you have at the end. And now you can ask questions, whoever wants to do that. I'm finished my presentation, and I've left at least 5 minutes or so for, but I'm willing to stay on a little bit after, too. Any questions or thoughts or comments?
Before we start the questions, I just want to thank you. This is a wonderful talk, and it really gave me a lot to think about. And I really admire the work you've done. So thank you very much.
Oh, you're very welcome.
Hi. Hello. Hi. This is Diana in Gettysburg. I'm just a general practitioner, general psychologist. I don't specialize at all in substance abuse, but certainly lots of the people that I see have some, you know, substance abuse issues. This is a lot for me to absorb. It's very interesting. I'm wondering if you could walk us through two different profiles, two different cases. So, like, I'm looking at, you know, defining severity of addiction slides, and I'm wondering if you could walk us through, you know, a narrative of what a couple of cases would look like.
Sure. I could just kind of run through quickly. So some of our people in Project Match were in the VA hospital.
Okay.
So some of them had been using for 20 or 30 years, if I think about the alcohol stuff, blood alcohol levels. So this blood alcohol level can also tell you a little bit about, you know, how much they're able to consume, can tell you a little bit about neuroadaptation as well. So this person was drinking, the coordinating center sent back a note and said, this is impossible. If he drank this much on a day, he would be dead or in coma. I'm going, no, this is how much he drinks. His blood alcohol level on those days is 0.4. So that's somebody whose neuroadaptation, this is a very severe kind of use disorder. His self-regulation, he has very little control over his drinking. Once he starts drinking, he could not stop. It's affected a lot of his life. He's got a divorce and got a lot of things going on. So that's certainly one. We've also had some business people who come in. Much of their life is intact, but they're doing binge drinking multiple times every time they go to business meetings. So the binge drinking does get them in. They're hanging out. They're staying longer. At, you know, their last months leave the bar from the business meeting. But their system's intact. They're still married. They're still getting their job done, probably not well, but they're still, you know, something we call functional in that sense. But this drinking is really impacting their lives. And in that setting, their self-regulation is low. But the neuroadaptation is not everyday drinking. They only do it once a month or something. So the brain hasn't had a lot of alcohol to kind of cope with and make a lot of the brain changes. So much of that may be a self-regulation issue and using alcohol to cope with the anxiety of the business meeting. So that person is very different from the first person. And you'd want to think about how to manage that person differently. The other thing I'd say is, when you get to up to severity and when you have all of these mechanisms very severe, it means you need residential treatment. You need scaffolding. So we talk about, you know, people who have lost self-regulatory process, they need to kind of have scaffolding. So I was talking this week with we're doing a project on pregnancy, substance exposed pregnant women and their children. And I have a mom who was pregnant and using heroin, and it was really interesting. She kind of said, and they put her in jail. She said, when they locked the door on the jail cell, I finally felt free. So the prison, the locking, actually was ensuring that she was going to be safe from these substances. And it was an interesting kind of comment. So I do think that those two different profiles require very different ways to think about treatment and very different support systems.
Okay, hello. Thanks.
You're welcome.
Hello, is there time for another question?
Sure.
Dr. P. Clemente, how do you evaluate the audit assessment that seems like our government is very promoting of that assessment?
So the audit is a screen, from my perspective, not an assessment. So I think that's really, you know, we should be using the audit as a screener. I do think it tells you a good bit about what the pattern is like, and I think you'll find that the audit will give you some quantity frequency. It will give you a little bit of maybe self-regulation and salience kinds of stuff. So it kind of comes in, but I think if you're going to do an assessment, you'd need a more extensive assessment of the mechanisms and the other areas that I talked about. There was another person asking the question.
Yeah,
you're welcome.
My name is Robert Schwebel, and I'm amazed. When I first got the PowerPoint, I had no idea how you could get through so many slides. But thank you for such an interesting and fast-moving presentation. I've been a follower of the trans-theoretical model since, I think it was 1993 when American psychologists first wrote about it. And I've been dying to ask a question, which is this. What happened to the termination stage? Originally, there was discussion about people are done with the problem, and I was wondering whether there was a psychological explanation for that no longer being there, or was that some sort of a concession maybe to the 12 steps idea of people are always in recovery?
No, actually, it's kind of contrary to the 12-step kind of notion. So termination, so that from a change process perspective, we have lots of things that we need to change. And at some point, we talk about maintenance. And then at some point, you know, especially for quitting substances like smoking. So, I mean, I'm now off smoking now for 25, 30 years. No, 30 years. More than 30. I don't want to go there. But basically, so for me, I could go back to smoking, but it would be a reinitiation, not a relapse. So I think that what's important there is the process of going back is different once you've reached a certain point. And that's functional in terms of the stuff we need to do, because we're talking about recovery as a long-term process, right? That also includes wellness. Well, we have to be able to kind of use resources. If I'm using my resources every day to focus on my drinking, even after I've been off for 5 months or 5 years, then I still have to be aware. I'm still vulnerable. It's not like I'm saying, oh, you don't have to worry about anything. But termination says, okay, now I'm in a state where I need to now focus on other problems. Now I got weight and exercise and heart and all the other kind of stuff that I need to do. But I'm not focused on this. And you know, maybe that happens. I mean, I think there may be some people who are in perpetual maintenance, but I think there's a lot of people who go through who are able to terminate the process of change for this particular behavior and then move on.
But that was my question. Why is it not listed as one of the stages anymore?
Well, so termination was never a stage, okay? It was an end state.
Yeah.
So it's not, and we always said, I mean, in the original work that where we talked about termination, it was, you know, it should be done functionally. It's not, so for research purposes, we say, okay, if you're off 2 years or more, then we'll call you termination, or 5 years, we'll call it termination. But it's really functional for the individual, because the individual has to decide, and the only markers we have are temptation is really high, confidence is really high, temptation is really low, they're not using any processes, they don't have to use any processes of change in order to keep this behavior pattern in place, this new behavior pattern in place. So that's why, I mean, I think in the Changing for Good book, I was not happy that it labeled six stages of change, because I don't think of termination as a stage. And that's where Jim and I probably disagree a little bit. That help?
Yes, it did. Yes, it
did. Okay, great. Thanks. Any other questions?
This is Tom Horvath in San Diego.
Hi, Tom.
Hello. So how often do you see someone move through the processes of change in roughly the proper order and successful and over months to years getting a good outcome in a relatively smooth fashion?
Oh, nice question, Tom. It's not, I mean, I think it's hard. I mean, if you look retrospectively, so when I make a presentation to people who actually are in recovery, and they come up to me and say, that's, yes, I recognize that. I recognized how I recognized my journey in that process. So retrospectively, I think you can kind of see it. In the midst of it, I think it's really hard. Do I know that this time that this person is going through this, these stages, that this is going to be the it? We're not very good at predicting long-term success for some of our people. Some of the people we thought were going to do the worst have done the best. So I'm not sure, you know, the process isn't linear, as we've said before. I mean, it goes back and forth. I mean, we've seen people come in and they start planning to change, and they have a change plan, and then they drop out of treatment when they go back to using. This mom I was just talking about, she said, oh, I tried to get off on my own early in the pregnancy, and I was off for maybe a month, and then I just had to go back. And then later I got off. She then went into a program. She got support. She got housing. She had her baby. She's now over 4 years in recovery and counseling. But that process was jerky. It didn't go forward always in a straight line. So I don't know. I don't know the percentage of people.
Thanks.
You're welcome. Sorry.
Hey,
any
guys.
Other questions?
I think it's like about 10 minutes over. I think we need to let Dr. DiClemente go, unless you want to keep going.
Well, if there's another question, I'll answer one more. That's often the key to death.
Well, I actually have one question, which is looking back at the slide, which describes the state. Wait a minute, let me find it. The use patterns, mechanisms, and domains. Have you developed any kind of instrument to assess that and help with the treatment planning?
So I've identified indicators that I think would be important for neurobiological adaptation, for self-regulation, and for, but we haven't done a process yet. So if there's someone on the call who wants to work on build an assessment for that, we've not done that yet. Because I think, you know, obviously fMRI would be a best way to look at neuroadaptation, neurobiological adaptation, but we're not going to fMRI all of our patients. So we need to find behavioral markers that are reflective of the fMRI patterns that we see in brain functioning. And that's the challenge. I think that's what Regina Singh is doing, some of that, because she's looking at relapse and looking at some of the brain markers. But no, I haven't done that yet, Mark, so we need to kind of think about that.
Because I think that would be so much more valuable than something like the ASAM, which is really a cookie-cutter approach.
Yes, I agree. I mean, ASAM includes motivation, but it really has no way to measure all of those 1.5, 2.3. There's a lot of assumed specificity in the ASAM that I think is not quite there.
Right.
You know, and David Midlay does a good job trying to teach people how to do that, but it's innately needs something else.
Right. Well, again, thanks so much for providing the talk. For the people who are left on, I hope to see you on March 8th for Deborah Rothschild talking about relational psychoanalysis and substance use disorders. And thank you all for joining us.
Thanks, Mark, for organizing it.
Bye. Thank you.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.